I am so honored to be here with you all today, and it is quite humbling to have the opportunity to address this audience. As someone who studies domestic poverty, income inequality, and economic mobility, I've long been intrigued by the relative success of Utah. As many of you might know, when it comes to rates of poverty, income inequality, and economic mobility, Utah boasts some of the best outcomes in the nation. I also feel a bit sheepish standing here today because it is not lost on me that the big takeaway from my research that I'm here to share will likely strike many in the Latter-day Saints community as rather obvious. The big takeaway I'm here to announce is that based on the research that I have done as an economist for the past 25 years, I can say with the backing of mounds of evidence that family is critically important. Okay, so some of you might be thinking, really, that's what this economist came to tell us? We know that. And I can hear my Italian grandma with her eighth grade level of education teasing me from heaven. Melissa, that's what you went to all that school and did all that studying to learn? I could have told you that. However, though this insight will likely not surprise many in this audience, it is a bit controversial in other crowds. The topic of family and family structure, and what has happened to the American family over recent decades, is often declared as out of bounds in policy conversations. Even when it is not declared out of bounds, it is not given priority. That is a big mistake, and it has ultimately been very counterproductive. What has happened to families in the U.S. over the past 40 years, by which I mean specifically the decline in marriage and the corresponding rise in the share of children growing up outside a two-parent home, has not been good for our nation's children. Furthermore, it has exacerbated income inequality and undermined social mobility. It is cementing class and racial gaps in opportunities and in outcomes. And it is something that we need to tackle as a policy and economic priority. I am convinced, based on data and evidence, that the declining share of children living in a married parent home is both a cause and a consequence of economic and social challenges facing our nation. To improve the lives of American children, to reduce poverty and income inequality, and to close gaps between racial and ethnic groups in this country, we need to make strong families a national priority. This is the case I make in my recent book titled The Two-Parent Privilege. This is a book written through an economics lens, not a moral, religious, or value-laden one. I wrote this book drawing on my experience as an economist who has been studying these issues for over two decades. But while this book is based entirely on data and scholarly evidence, my own life experience is not irrelevant to why I believe this message is so important. In addition to being an economist, I'm the mother of three children, and I know how wonderful and fulfilling, but also how hard and exhausting it is to raise children. I'm the wife of a committed husband who is a loving and present father to our children. I'm also the daughter of two people who didn't have fancy degrees or a lot of money, but who gave my sisters and me the best gift they could have possibly given us, a stable home with the unconditional love and support of two parents. All this is to say that while I come to this topic as a scholar, I am also someone who is both a parent and a child, knows firsthand the many advantages that come from a two-parent family. When I wrote this book, I fully expected that there would be some people who would read the title and based on that alone, push back. I will admit, however, I did not quite anticipate just how swift and fierce that reaction would be. Immediately after my book came out, there were essays in the New York Times, The Cut, and Salon Magazine taking issue with my message. There was a scathing book review in the Washington Post that declared me stuck in the trap of convention. But there were also a lot of affirming reviews, including in the Wall Street Journal, The New Yorker, The Economist, and the Financial Times, among others. But what has been most bolstering to me is that over the course of these months since the book came out, I have received a steady stream of emails, messages, and letters from single parents, divorced parents, grandparents who are helping raise their grandchildren because one of the parents isn't around, adults who were raised by a single parent or divorced parent, all have reached out to tell me that my book resonates with them. They want to tell me about their struggles. They want their story to be told and understood. I've also received many emails and messages from teachers and pediatricians who have written to tell me that they have seen the trends that I am writing about play out in their classrooms and in their offices, and they are relieved that somebody is willing to call attention to this as a widespread economic and social problem. So I stand here today even more emboldened than when I wrote the book to call attention to the decline in marriage and the two-parent family as an economic and social challenge facing our nation, and to say with absolute conviction that we need, as a society, to make strong families a national priority. Okay, with that motivation, I want to spend the next few minutes describing with statistics the trends that I call attention to in the book. So the first set of statistics I'm showing here is based on official U.S. Census data, and it shows children's living arrangements in the United States. And what you can see is that the share of U.S. children living with married parents has fallen from 77% to 63%. Let's pause on that number for just a moment. Now, just over 60% of children in the U.S. live with married parents. That is strikingly low. And yet, the share of children who will spend their entire childhood living continuously with married parents is even lower. Importantly, the share of children living with cohabiting unmarried parents doesn't bring this anywhere close to 100%. Only 8% of U.S. children live with cohabiting parents, meaning at least one parent and that parent's unmarried partner. But even that small number overstates the share of children who are living with their two biological parents. In many of those arrangements, their parent's partner is not their other parent. A very large share of U.S. children, 21%, live with an unpartnered mother. 4.5% live with an unpartnered father, and the remainder live with neither parent. Another way to put these statistics is that 30% of U.S. children are living outside a two-parent home. The share of children in the U.S. living with only one parent is higher than in any of the other 130 countries for which we have this data. This is an exceptionalism that we should not be proud of, and one that does not serve our nation's children well. Furthermore, this is not because of the economic success of American women. It is not the most highly educated or economically successful women in our country who have moved towards single parenting in large numbers. To the contrary, this trend has been driven by those without a college degree. So this next figure shows the share of children living in married parent families by their mother's level of education. And what we can see in this figure is the emergence over the past 40 years of a very large college gap in married parent families. In 2019, 84% of children whose mothers had a four-year college degree lived with married parents, reflecting a decline of only 6 percentage points since 1980. Meanwhile, only 60% of children whose mothers had a high school degree or some college lived with married parents, reflecting a very large decline of 23 percentage points since 1980. Among children whose mothers did not finish high school, the share living with married parents fell from 73% in 1980 to 57% in 2019. This dramatic decline in married parent families outside the college-educated class has happened in all regions of the country and in both rural and urban areas. It is now the case that marriage and married parent families for children has become yet another advantage or privilege disproportionately experienced by the most highly educated in our society. And I want to emphasize something important here at a macro level. This divergence in family structure has amplified the rise in income inequality, and it has exacerbated the economic insecurity of the middle class. College-educated workers have seen their earnings rise unabated over the past 40 years, while they have continued to get married and raise families as married couples. Meanwhile, those in the middle of the education distribution have experienced only small increases in earnings or stagnant earnings, while at the same time, they have become substantially more likely to be setting up a household on their own without another adult in their home. The combination of labor market trends and demographic trends means that inequality across households is even larger now than it would have been from the rise in earnings inequality alone. And the fact that so many more adults outside the college-educated class are setting up a household without a partner has weakened their economic security and made their lives more financially precarious and stressful. This is why changing marriage patterns and family structure needs to be part of our national conversation around income inequality and economic insecurity. Okay, so now I want to turn to directly addressing why these trends matter so much for children. The basic fact is that children who grow up without two parents in their home are at a substantial disadvantage to relative to kids who do. That is not to say that children who are raised by a single mother can't go on to achieve great things. Of course they can, and many do. But we cannot deny that poverty rates are 5 times higher among children growing up in single mother households as compared to those growing up in married parent households. Nor can we ignore the mounds of social science evidence showing that the odds of graduating high school, getting a college degree, and having high earnings and being married as an adult are all substantially lower for children who grow up in single mother homes. And this is true even when we take into account mothers' background characteristics and other potential confounding factors. Research has established a clear link between family structure and children's outcomes, both at an individual level and at a community level. So a very recent influential study from the Opportunity Insights Lab at Harvard has shown that at a community level, the share of households headed by married parents is one of the most positive, strong predictors of a community's rate of upward mobility. And as some of you might know, that same research showed that Salt Lake City, Utah, has the highest rate of social mobility among all U.S. metropolitan areas. It is also the case that Salt Lake City has one of the lowest rates of single-parent households. None of this is to blame single parents. We need to recognize that many of those parents are doing the best they can, and they are their children's greatest assets. But parenting is hard, and two parents combined have more resources than one parent alone. Two adults have greater earnings capacity, and unsurprisingly, married parent households tend to have about twice as much income as single parent households, even controlling for other background characteristics of those parents. The fact that those households have so much more income affects the types of neighborhoods their kids live in and the types of schools they attend. It also means that married parent households tend to have a lot more money to spend on their children's educational and enrichment activities. But it is not just income and spending. We also see in nationally representative data that married parents spend more time investing in their children. I suspect this too feels commonsensical to many people in this audience. If you are the only parent in the household and you are the one person responsible for bringing in income, making dinner, driving the kids around, cleaning the house, you likely don't have as much time as your married counterpart to sit down and help your child with their homework. You are also less likely to have the emotional bandwidth to patiently nurture your child or engage with them as you might like to. And we see this in studies too. Single-parent households are characterized by higher levels of stress. I really can't emphasize this enough. None of this is to denigrate or dismiss the very hard work that single parents are doing, or to suggest that they don't want as much for their children as married parents. Rather, acknowledging the reality that single parents tend to have less money, time and emotional bandwidth to devote to their children rather as compared to their married peers helps us understand why children who grow up in single-parent households are at a relative disadvantage. We also know from very rigorous research that boys are at a particular disadvantage when they are growing up in a home without a father. They are significantly more likely to get in trouble in school and with the law, and they are less likely to achieve educational and economic markers of success. This all creates a terrible, vicious cycle. We need to break the intergenerational persistence of single-parent households and help more boys grow up to be reliable marriage partners and fathers. Everyone who cares about children, about women, about men, and about society, and about advancing equality of opportunity and outcomes should care deeply about this problem of what has happened to the American family over the past four decades. Now, of course, in some situations, there is no real choice. Some people are single parents because they are widowed, or because the second parent up and left, or because their relationship was abusive and violent. To be clear, nothing I am saying should be misconstrued to suggest that anyone should stay in an abusive or violent situation. While we work to help more people achieve healthy relationships and stable two-parent families, we must also meet people where they are, acknowledge whatever hardships or barriers might prevent them from living in a married setting, and support them with the resources they need to thrive. So this brings me to my next question. Given the advantages of two-parent homes, why are so many U.S. children now living outside that family structure? Okay. First, this is not because of a rise in divorce. Divorce rates conditional on marriage are down. Rather, this reflects a rise in the share of parents who have never been married. Here I am showing you trends in the marital status of unpartnered mothers. In 1980, 64% of unpartnered mothers were divorced and 22% were never married. In 2019, 39% of unpartnered mothers were divorced and 52% were never married. This matters descriptively because it tells us what is underlying the change in children's family structure, but it also matters because this itself is consequential. Children whose parents are divorced will have spent at least some of their childhood in a two-parent home, and they are more likely than children whose parents have never been married to receive financial support and spend time with their second parent. Children whose parents have never been married are the most disadvantaged when it comes to missing out on parental resources. Furthermore, there is a class gap here, too. College-educated mothers who are unpartnered are more likely to be divorced than never married. The reverse is true among unpartnered mothers without a college degree. Second, as another point of fact, the increase in the share of children living outside a two-parent home has happened despite declining birth rates and a stunning drop in teen childbearing. So mothers are older and more educated than in the recent past, and yet the non-marital birth share has more than doubled. 4 out of 10 births in the U.S. are now to unmarried mothers. 4 out of 10. This is an increase from 18% in 1980. When we look at the education level of mothers, we see that the largest increase has been among mothers in the middle of the education distribution. So among mothers with a high school degree or some college, but not a four-year college degree, the share of their births that are outside of marriage has increased from 25% to 52% in 2019. This is why marriage plays such an important role in the economic story I tell in my book. It is really the changing patterns in marriage and the decoupling of marriage from having and raising children that has led to such a profound change in children's family structure in this country. So the next set of figures plots the shares of men and women between the ages of 30 and 50 who are married going back to 1960. And we can see in these figures that amid the watershed social, legal, and institutional changes of the 1960s and 1970s, marriage rates fell among all groups of adults in roughly equal proportion across the educational distribution. But then in the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000s, the decline in marriage stalled out among those with a four-year college degree, but it continued its steady decline down among those with just a high school degree or some college. College-educated men and women are now much more likely to be married than men and women with lower levels of education. Again, what we're seeing is that marriage has become something of a luxury good, yet another advantage enjoyed disproportionately by the most economically advantaged group in our society, the college-educated. So why did this happen? So my research leads me to believe it is because of both social and economic changes. The broad sweeping narrative that I put forward in my book to explain these changes can be summarized as follows. The 1960s and 1970s brought about major changes in social expectations and norms around marriage, gender roles, and fertility that led to a decline in marriage and a rise in non-marital childbearing. Then we went into the 1980s, 1990s, and early 2000s, and our country experienced a number of economic shocks that affected different groups differently. In particular, the impact of technological change, the adoption of industrial robots, and increased import competition from China all had pretty punishing effects on the labor market outcomes of men in particular without a college degree. And this affected marriage rates. Why? Because the secular marital contract is as much an economic one as anything else. This might not sound very romantic, but that contract involves two adults making a long-term commitment to pool their resources and run a household together. That is a reality. And once we're in a world where men are no longer viewed as reliable breadwinners or stable economic partners, and where women are bringing in just as much earnings as men, then the economic attractiveness of that contract becomes weaker. Combine that with a greater social acceptance of non-marriage, even among adults who have a child together, and what we wind up with is more unmarried parents and ultimately more children growing up in a single-parent home. This is not just hypothetical speculation. There are rigorous empirical studies documenting a causal link from the economic shocks that I've mentioned to a reduction in marriage, a rise in single-parent households, and a rise in child poverty. The fact that economic challenges have spilled over from the labor market to the sphere of the family, with profound implications for children and society, heightens the imperative to address these economic challenges and promote widespread employment and economic security. The problem is that now we're in a new social paradigm, where childbearing and marriage have been decoupled, at least outside the college-educated class, such that economic improvement alone is not going to be enough to reverse the trend. So to be honest, for a long time, I held the view that if we could just improve the economic position of men without a college degree, we'd see a turnaround in the decline in marriage and the rise in non-marital childbearing. But then research I did with Riley Wilson, who is now on the economics faculty here at BYU, changed my thoughts about that. Because what our research showed was that's not the case. So we investigated what happened to family formation in response to local area fracking booms, which increased the employment and earnings of non-college educated men. And we found that in these communities, people responded to their improved financial position by having more kids, but it didn't matter whether they were married or not. And to our surprise, there was no change in the non-marital birth share. Now, interestingly and tellingly, this family formation response differs from what happened during the coal boom and bust of the 1970s and 1980s. In that episode, which affected very similar communities, the increase in men's earnings led to an increase in marriage and a reduction in the non-marital share of births. This and other evidence leads me to the conclusion that economic and social forces interact and reinforce one another. So in the 1970s and 1980s, when the link between marriage and having children was much tighter, we saw a different response. Now that link has been severed in many communities, and so even something like an increase in income that leads to an increase in births does not lead to an increase in marriage or reduction in the share of children being raised outside a married parent home. This implies that reversing the trends I have been talking about will be pretty difficult. It will require both economic and social changes. And this brings me to my final set of observations, which is about what I think we can and should do going forward. Ultimately, I do think that we need to work to restore a widespread norm and an expectation of two-parent homes for children in this country. And we need to do this without stigmatizing the single parents who are doing the best they can. It has to be a positive and affirming message. We also need to take dedicated, wide-scale efforts to improve the economic position of non-college-educated workers, especially the men who have been left behind in recent decades. And we need to do this without bemoaning the economic opportunities that have opened up for women. What are the kinds of things I have in mind? Well, we should create more pathways to well-paying jobs, and we should invest in community colleges and career and technical programs that provide skill building and job training to millions of young people and mid-career adults. We also need to meet families where they are and invest in programs that help parents achieve stable, healthy relationships and be the best parents that they can be. There are community organizations around the country running fatherhood programs, relationship education classes, and co-parenting programs. We need more evidence about what works and what doesn't in these spheres, and then we need to scale up funding for the programs that show promising results. And perhaps above all, we need to do so much more in this country to take care of children and make sure no child is left to endure poverty and hardship because of the situation they were born into. So to conclude, two-parent families are beneficial for children. The class divide in marriage and family structure has exacerbated inequality and class gaps. Places that have more two-parent families have higher rates of upward mobility. Not talking about these facts is counterproductive. Not doing anything about these facts is defeatist. Strong families need to be a national priority. Thank you for having me.